Good day, everybody. Welcome to another exciting, scintillating, and fun episode of the OIG Roundtable. Here with my compadres, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the Office of Investigations LA office, and now a manager on our SIU investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, retired executive from HHS OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and now our payment integrity director here at Advise. So good to have you guys. And today we want to talk about compliance, two pieces of the compliance puzzle, right? There's internal compliance from the SIU perspective, and there's compliance from the provider perspective. And I think we're gonna address both of those in kind of a little bit of a different manner as it goes. But, you know, the first piece, and Wade, I want to start with you, is, you know, the Affordable Care Act gets passed in 2010. And one of the requirements under the Affordable Care Act is that if you are a participating provider in Medicare and Medicaid, so on the Medicare side, you've completed the 855 application and you have enrolled in Medicare or the state's Medicaid plan and whatever that state enrollment form is called, one of the requirements is that you agree and attest to the fact that you have what is considered to be an effective compliance program. Now, an effective compliance program is not one that you wrote and sat on a shelf for 5 years and never touched it. An effective compliance program is not something that you took off of a template from a Word document. It is a document that you're looking at least once a year. We recommend actually twice a year. Our general counsel here at Advise says you should be looking at them twice a year. She does them, puts them together, reviews them. And says we should be doing them twice a year because the regulatory landscape changes constantly. And so you need to be kept abreast. And if you fall behind in the regulations and you're out of regulatory guidance, you could be running afoul of certain statutes, whether it be healthcare fraud statutes, False Claims Act, Stark, or the anti-kickback statute, to name a few. And so an effective compliance program is one that you're actually implementing and going about and looking at that. And OIG has a website entirely dedicated to compliance programs, effective compliance programs for different types of providers, facilities, and standalone providers, ambulance providers, skilled nursing facilities, all different types of compliance programs are out there. And there are 7 different points to an effective compliance program, and not all of them will necessarily be in line with what a particular practice needs to do. However, most of them are, and it's an important piece of the puzzle for that. And having a good compliance program might prevent providers from having met Wade, me, and Matt in our prior lives, and certainly our compadres today. Obviously, the fraudsters, those you are involved in the F word, don't care so much about that, but those in the W and A might. And so, Wade, you know, we do a lot of work in New York, and while I had a difficult time finding any ramifications on the Medicare side for not having an effective compliance program, the one thing that I did find pretty quickly, which I thought was interesting, was in New York State. New York State's Office of Medicaid Inspector General has an actual rule that took effect in March of 2023 that actually calls for a $5,000 a month penalty for providers who do not have an effective compliance program. Now, obviously, one of the pieces of the puzzle are from an SIU perspective. Does the SIU have the ability to request effective compliance program documents or compliance program documents from the provider? That's a network agreement determination. And obviously, we would be saying that in a network agreement, providers should be required to do that. But Wade, from an investigative perspective, and then also kind of parlaying it back to, I know we sound like a broken record sometimes, but parlaying it back to the importance of that relationship between the payer slash SIU and state regulatory bodies, because right, not having an effective compliance program doesn't inherently create a criminal matter for Mafuku or needing a law enforcement type person, but certainly having those relationships with those external stakeholders, but then also having strong relationships internally for example, network and credentialing. You know, is there language in those agreements that allows the SIU to look for those documents, or does that require the provider to produce those kind of things? So kind of an open-ended discussion, but there's a lot of tentacles that come about as a result.
Yeah, and as you said too, it's just recently in 2023 that they're requiring that because prior to that, it was always a voluntary program, which was not required, but obviously made sense to have a compliance program, especially seeing that the OIG makes it easy with their website compliance toolkit, et cetera. If the OIG is going to come knocking at your door and asking questions about, you know, whatever fraud related stuff, to be able to say, look, we have this effective compliance plan that we instituted a year ago, whatever, and we have the elements, we have regular training, the training is recorded so we can show that all the employees have gone through the training, there's like a compliance officer who reports to the CEO or the leadership, again, the training, lines of communication for reporting something, you have to have that element of being able to report something anonymously, and there's no, retaliation, all those things. But as far as going back to your question, in the SIU world, you want to at least be able to confirm that they have that. And it's one thing to trust them on their word and say, yeah, we have an effective compliance plan. Effective, you could have a whole podcast on talking about what's effective and what's not. But if you can ask them, and you should be able to ask them, like you said, put it in the contract, ask them for a copy of their compliance plan so you can review it. You can ensure that there is training. The training is up to date, effective, and it's updated, yearly or whenever there's, changes to the regulations. Maybe it's got to be more than once or twice a year if there's a big change, but also showing that there's that infrastructure where people can report stuff. They can do it without fear of retaliation. I know another part of that is that they should have a code of ethics for the company, and that includes things such as having a culture of compliance where you're not only free to report things, but you're really required to. If you see something that you think is on the fringes of being fraudulent, that's something that you are required to report up the chain of command. So I think as far as the SIU, it's as you stated, it's kind of a two different angles on the compliance program within the SIU and within the provider that the SIUs are kind of controlling or monitoring. But it's definitely worth reaching out and making sure that they have it, and two, getting a copy of it so you can review it and make sure it is effective, an effective compliance program that's updated. It's a living document. As you said, it's not sitting on the shelf collecting dust. And there's updated training and things of that nature going on a regular basis.
Right. And obviously, from our perspective, we're not here to have a debate with the provider about whether their compliance program is effective or not, right? Because some of those may be legal decisions. They may be for people who are in the regulatory space or the compliance space about whether something is an effective compliance program or not. It's just a starting point, right? But, the one thing that you brought up, which is this culture of compliance, and, I did a podcast a while ago with our general counsel, Julie Janeway. You can find that on our YouTube channel and in Spotify, where we talked about compliance as a culture and the importance of having a culturally compliant group of people working and having the impetus for people to be able to report, things. I mean, we do a lot of presentations for AAPC chapters, American Association of Professional Coders, and I can't tell you how often we do these presentations and we open the field for questions, and the auditor or the coder will raise their hand and they'll say, I have a situation. My doctor wants me to code something this way and it's against the rules, or it's this reason or it's that reason. What do I do? And the very first question I ask is, what does your compliance manual say, or your compliance program? What's your guidance? We don't have one. Who's your compliance officer? We don't have one. It's a small shop. We don't have one. And it's like, well, what do you do at that point, right? And it becomes a little bit of a conversation. So it's a multitude of things that create that. Most providers, I think, do not have a compliance program in place. Particularly, I think, when you start getting into these smaller groups, when you're talking about these kind of corporate or PE-backed groups, there's going to be a compliance program. And obviously, what we've seen over the years is you may have a compliance program, but it's clearly not effective when you see these multi, you know, million-dollar settlements involving corporate practice of medicine groups and things of that sort. So having a compliance program and even having one that may be considered effective is ineffective. You can go through and do all of the work to identify gaps in your compliance, but at the end of the day, if you're not going to follow through on identifying where those gaps are to be plugged, it's not going to go anywhere. So, Matt, I want to go to you because now, you know, you've got it's external compliance, but there's also internal. And, you know, that then comes into things like, you know, on the ROI, but, you know, compliance as a culture is also internally from the organization and how the organization operates for things like consistency, professionalism, and believability.
Sure. Before we get into that, I just wanted to follow up on something, you know, Wade was talking about. You know, we've had cases just recently, personally, I've had some cases where, you know, we've calculated an overpayment, retroactive, you know, post-pay type of thing. And the person that's responding is the compliance officer. And even these were a couple of small providers. So it was good to see that. And what they presented in rebuttal was, yeah, we found these problems too. We're doing a self-audit, or we've got a corrective action plan in place, and here's how we're going to stop this from happening in the future. And that does have an impact on how an SIU is going to resolve a case. You know, it could be, you know, we do interviews of people in the provider's office, and they're like, yeah, they got a compliance plan, but nobody follows it. They don't enforce it. It's just a beard. You know, that's one thing. But here they're actually practicing it. So that's going to have an impact on how we resolve something in terms of the overpayment settlement or referral to another agency might not occur at this point. So it's important to see that. On the other side of that coin, the SIUs themselves, and the program integrity arm of the plan, they need to have compliance as well. You know, an SIU needs to work within specific guardrails on how they do their business, whether that be documentation standards in the file, how to conduct interviews, how to not prejudge and, you know, use data objectively to find subjects that are legitimately aberrant in their billing and not prejudging things, to how do they prioritize things? How do they do statistical sampling? How do they create samples, random samples, sizes? Everything has to be consistent because all of those things come into question when cases are being resolved through an ALJ or a court. If, let's say, Wade does a sample of 30 medical records on his case, but the policy says do 25 or do 10, and everybody else is doing different numbers, Wade is going to be on the stand having to explain why his were different. Why did you approach this case differently? So you have to be consistent right in your processes so that your outcomes will be supportable by the compliance documentation and practices that you have in place, so that there's no argument about how you got to where you got to be at the end of the case.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this incessantly. When we do our SIU trainings, on podcasts, we've talked about this. We blog about what, you know, when we're talking about data analytics and we're talking about SSOE, statistical sampling overpayment estimation, and Chapter 8 of the CMS Program Integrity Manual and the parallel Chapter 8 in the Medicaid Payment Integrity Manual, where it talks about probe sampling, statistical sampling. And in the probe sampling world, they say it's 20 to 40 records right from CMS. And we always say, pull 30. We tell all of our SIU clients, 30. Be consistent. Why is it 30? Just in the middle. But consistency. If Wade is pulling 20 records, if Matt's pulling 30 and I'm pulling 40, no consistency. And someone will ultimately say, why did you pull 20? Why did you pull 30? Why did you pull 40? Consistency. it's that culture of compliance internally works towards that professionalism that when you are on the stand, you can say, look, we pull 30 because we have a policy that says it. It's the same thing internally as an effective compliance program for a provider, right? It's having a set of procedures that create a culture of compliance for the organization. Now, Matt, you know, you and Wade both spent time in leadership, Matt as an assistant special agent in charge, you as a special agent in charge, and then really at the UPIC where you were managing 100 plus people and the budget. You know, the biggest problem is getting people to follow the rules within the organizational structure. So I want to go to you, Matt, and then Wade, I want to get to you for the final word on kind of the motivation, but where do you see, you know, it's not about the pain points for people. It's about getting them to agree to that culture. And I know when you were at the UPIC, you spent a lot of time on the process and rejiggering the process and the manual. What was the biggest thing that you found that people were giving either resistance or pushback, or where was the biggest pain point for the staff?
I think the biggest pain point was in documentation. I mean, teaching them how to document a case that told the story of the case so that a cold audience, someone that has no idea what this case is about, can sit down, read the case file notes that you're putting down, understanding what the allegation was, why you opened the case, what was the program vulnerability that you were addressing, what was the priority of it, what steps did you take and why, what the results of those steps were, why those results brought you to the next steps, and then ultimately, what was the result or the resolution of the case, and how is it supported by the facts that you uncovered? Getting them to understand the importance of that documentation, because, you know, as a writer, I'm writing for me. You know, this is my case. I just need to jot down something so I can remember it. That mindset has to go away to, I need to write something so that someone else understands it. It was that hurdle that was the toughest for us to get through. And the way we did it is we did quality assurance checks on cases. We would go and look at a sample of cases, open, closed, leads, and we would review them with certain set criteria in mind and grade the documentation in those cases and then train people as to what they were missing.
And part of that is the creation of, from the internal SIU, is some manner to track those case movements. Oh. Through yes. things like quarterly case reviews, right? So correct. I know we've talked yeah. about this. At the Office of Investigations, we have something called the Office of Investigations Policy and Procedure Manual, the OIPPM. It's basically the roadmap of how to operate as an investigator from the policy perspective, when you need to do this, when you do that. And there was a whole section on case file management. And from a managerial perspective, right, it's setting a form to get together so that you can meet with the people on your team and ensure, are they being compliant? Are you touching a case every 30, 60, 90 days, whatever the prescribed amount is, right? It's keeping track of those things so that investigators are not falling behind on their cases, keeping them documented, moving them forward, things of that sort. So it's a great segue because, Wade, I want to get to you for that last bit because as an ASAC, Assistant Special Agent Charge, one of your responsibilities was to do file reviews and do them in a timely manner and kind of create the environment of continuing to have compliant culture within the investigators. And so, you know, for me, I always saw the file reviews were for positive feedback and to help you come up with maybe some idea on how to tackle something or move something forward. But at the end of the day, buy-in from the employees becomes sometimes an important piece of the puzzle that is often a challenge. So to give you the final word is kind of the little tidbits of advice. What are some of the things that you find to be ways to help to keep your investigators engaged in continuing to move their cases forward and do the work? Particularly, you know, some of these cases could take 18 months, 2 years to investigate. How do you keep people engaged?
Yeah, and it does go back to the seven elements of compliance. The first one is the written policies and procedures, which goes back again to the OIPPM, the program manual for the OIG. Excuse me. But in the file reviews, I think basically that policies and procedure manual, like you said, is a roadmap. Everybody who's working those types of cases wants to work them effectively. They want to work it to a conclusion that's, you know, what the goal is. And in order to do that, they have to follow certain steps. And that file review is pretty much a review to make sure those steps are being followed, that you're following the policies and procedure manual, and you're working towards that end goal. If it's a civil case, you're looking to make a civil settlement. If it's a criminal case, you're looking to, you know, indict somebody and put them in jail. So early on in the case, a roadmap should be developed as to, if we want to indict this person, you look at the allegation, how we're going to prove it, what elements we need, whether we're going to be doing interviews, undercovers, whatever. But you have that roadmap set out for the case that you said may take 18 months, 2 years, 3 or 4 years sometimes. And it's just a checkup with the agent working the case to say, you know, we spoke 60 days ago and we decided this would be our course of action. Have a bullet list of things that we're going to conduct interviews. We're going to do whatever. First of all, have we done that? Is it effectively documented? And we review that and then look going forward. Do we want to stay on the same track? Are we tracking to what we want to do? Is there something else we need to do in addition? Or do we need to kind of alter our plan? But it's really to bring back to that series of steps that you're taking, trying to get to that end goal and making sure that you're not getting sidetracked. You're going down some road that's not helping you prove the elements of the case. So it's really just a review to make sure that you're, one, following the policies and procedures, which is key to helping the agent get to the end goal, and making sure that you're still on track. It's just following those steps and reevaluating. Yeah. It might be, maybe the interviews aren't being productive. Maybe you have to go another route. Maybe you have to start, you know, looking at different records or trying to get phone records or whatever it may be. But it's just a reevaluation to make sure you're on track to get to that end result that you're working for with the prosecutor.
You know, and sometimes, you know, I always looked at case reviews as a check-in, you know, because oftentimes as an investigator, and particularly in today's environment where most people are working remotely, you kind of feel like you're an island and you're just kind of doing your thing and there's never any opportunity for interaction or check-in. You know, in the old days when everybody was office-based, it was a little bit easier. But to some extent, having a regular cadence of case reviews is really a way to ensure that there's a check-in, that people realize that you're not dead under a desk for 3 months, right? That you're actually out there working and doing something. And it's just a way to reconnect with people on a one-to-one basis, even if it's just for a short period of time, you know, outside of case reviews. But, you know, that culture of compliance, it's the culture of compliance internally is ensuring that people understand that these policies on how investigations are going to go forward are really created for the purposes of consistency and that professionalism. And people tend to forget oftentimes that just because you're an SIU investigator doesn't mean at some point you're not going to have to testify. You're not going to have to do an affidavit. You're not going to be deposed. You're not going to be in a trial, an ALJ hearing. I think most investigators, that doesn't happen, but you have to be prepared for it. And I think the one thing that I would always say is that culture of compliance helps to set you up for that. If you're always requesting 30 records, if you're always documenting your interviews this way and you're consistent, it's a comfortable conversation. It's not a difficult one because you're consistent. I request 30 records. I document my interview this way. I follow this roadmap. It becomes a much easier conversation to have, particularly for people who may be a little nervous about speaking in front of a group or what have you. So important pieces of the puzzle. Compliance externally, compliance internally can go a long way. Always remembering, individuals who don't care about following the rules none of the stuff we're talking about matters. People intent on committing fraud or people who want to come in and not follow the rules or whatever it may be, none of that applies. It doesn't really matter. So, you know, ongoing conversation. But I do think that if anybody in the provider community is watching, that you certainly should be looking at what your state regulations are with respect to a compliance program, effective compliance program in this space, particularly for Medicaid, because just looking at the example of New York State, the fact that it is a $5,000 a month penalty, that can be debilitating, particularly for providers that are heavily centered in the Medicaid space, where Medicaid is the payer of last resort and incomes may not be huge on those. So, you know, we see all the time providers in the Medicaid space where they owe $15,000, $20,000, and we put them on payment plans in our SIU space because it's Medicaid and there aren't a lot of dollars out there. So be cognizant of that and understand that the things that you do today will have an effect on how your practice operates tomorrow. So good conversation as always. I enjoy spending the time with both of you, getting your insights. As always, we appreciate everybody for participating in all of the stuff that we do here at Advise. We are proud to say that we have now grown to over 35,000 followers on LinkedIn. So we continue to appreciate people clicking and following us on LinkedIn. Every week, we put out a lot of content on LinkedIn, and every day we put in a lot of content. So again, you can always get our newsletter by signing up through our website, Advise, advizehealth.com. Get our newsletter, Spotify, YouTube for prior OIG roundtables, and our LinkedIn Lives, which are all scheduled out for the next several months. You can take a look at those. So as always, we appreciate everybody spending their time, and we'll see you all on the next LinkedIn Live. No, OIG roundtable. We'll see you on the next one, because I'm not wearing my shirt. I forgot where I was. We'll see you on the next OIG roundtable.
Thank you.